Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Big Ticket, Variety and iHeart's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. On today's show, I've got Sandra Oh. The Emmy-nominated and Golden Globe winner is here to talk about the new season of Killing Eve, how she's keeping herself sane during quarantine, and what's ahead for her once the world reopens. I'm going to have Oh later in the show, but first, Wagner Moura. You know him for his portrayal of Pablo Escobar in the Netflix series Narcos. But now he's back on the streamer in a new biopic about late Brazilian diplomat Sergio de Mello and his work with the United Nations, as well as his love affair with a UN economist, played by Ana de Armas, before he was killed in the Canal Hotel bombing in Baghdad in 2003. I'll be right back with Wagner Moura after the break. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Sergio star Wagner Moura. How are you?
I'm fine, man. It's a strange moment, but I'm fine. Personally, I'm very well. I'm here with my family, but of course, very concerned about everything.
How are you dealing with the quarantine and staying home and not doing much?
Ups and downs. Ups and downs. You know, like everybody else, I think. You know, there are days that I'm like more sad but honestly, I'm usually in a very good mood and I'm just very, very concerned about with Brazil and with, you know, the countries that have doesn't have strong ways to more vulnerable, more poorest countries. You know, that's Brazil's. I mean, of course, I talk about Brazil because I'm Brazilian. I'm in touch with my friends in there, but especially a country with a president like that one, you know, which makes it doesn't help. It makes things become worse, which is incredibly crazy.
Do you stay hopeful? Are you hopeful that things will change in Brazil?
I'm very optimistic with the, I'm very pessimistic with the present, but very optimistic with the future, which is...
What keeps you optimistic?
I'm optimistic because I think this, let's talk before coronavirus thing. I think this is politically, I think there are waves. You know, I think that Bolsonaro is a backlash of all the of the moment that we lived in Brazil in the past, the last 12 years of very progressive governments. As I think that Trump is a backlash of Obama's moment as well. And I think this is going to turn again at some point into a more liberal and of course the virus is exposing how weak are most of the world leaders nowadays, you know, and so I think that the whole history is made of these movements, of these waves. Right. That makes things change from time to time. But for sure, the pandemic is going to change everything in a way that we are about to discover that we don't know yet. I think that capitalism itself is in a position that people have to rethink. You know, if this is something that is really working. Or not. I'm not even saying that the world's going to go towards a socialist. It's going towards a post capitalism that we don't know yet what it is, because it's proven for me that this is not working. Or a system cannot only work in between crises.
So let's talk about Sergio. Great film. I'll admit, didn't know much about him. I kind of remember the attack, not that much. So tell me how you got involved. Tell us who Sergio is. Let's start with that.
This, Yeah, this film, I was, it's part of a more sort of more ambitious and kind of a political project that I have, which is to produce films here in the U.S. about Latin people that don't reinforce stereotypes. And Sergio was, I was always, since I was a kid, I was always very fascinated by the UN, by the United Nations, what that is, you know, what this ultimately is, a human rights organization, you know, but it's so weak when we need the UN, like in a stronger way, it's so weak when it receives pressure, especially from the US or from other powerful players. But then Sergio was killed in 2003. It was the first time that the UN was a central target of terrorism. And he was killed in Iraq after the invasion. And the UN was against the invasion. The UN didn't want to be there. Sergio personally didn't want to be there for personal reasons as well, for political reasons and for personal reasons that we can discuss later. But, you know, I thought that his life, his legacy, his example of being a man, first of all, a Brazilian man that comes from my country, a place that really lacks examples like him right now, and so it fit in this project that I have, and also I thought that it's his life had so many, because he was a man who was, Samantha Power's book is called "The Man who Tried to Save the World." So Sergio was a man who was constantly, you know, he was considered a mix of James Bond and Bob Kennedy, considered the world's Mr. Fix-It, the guy who was, you know, handsome dude who was there, charismatic, you know, very smart. Sergio received from the Sorbonne the highest educational degree that they can give to someone who, so he was an intellectual, but at the same time he was formed in the refugees camps of the United Nations Agency for Refugees. So he had very unique qualities. But for me, what this film is about, and the quality that Sergio had, that, you know, was above anything else, was empathy, which is something that's sort of the main reason which I wanted to make this film. And when we see in this pandemic how this value is lacking, you know, especially in the leaders of the world, Sergio was someone who could see people not as statistics or as numbers, or as he could see people as people. He could look at George W. Bush as a human being, and he could look at the janitor of his office as, in the same way.
How much did you know about him before going into the project? Was it more just really watching things on the news, or did you, you know, is this someone that, you know, you really followed?
I really follow him, especially after his death. When he was killed in, I knew who he was, but when he was killed in 2003, that had a huge impact on me. I mean, especially the way it happened, the way the rescue, and, you know, the fact that the UN was there and they didn't want to be there, and the invasion, and everything seemed so tragic. You know, for an actor's point of view, there was also my interest in who Sergio was, but I think everything was so tragic. And when I watched Greg Barker's documentary about Sergio, I was convinced that we had all the elements for a feature film, because not always the life of someone that you would admire and you think it's an important person, not always that life is gonna make it into an interesting film. You know, and I think that Sergio's life was full of contradictions, because he was at the same time, he was this world's Mr. Fix-It, but at the same time, he had a very chaotic personal life. He didn't, he couldn't organize his own, issues as a man and as a father and as a husband. And as, so that was a very interesting thing for me. In terms of character.
So I have to admit, when I started watching the film with my husband, because we were big Narcos fans, I was like, wait a minute. How is that the guy who played Pablo Escobar? Yeah. And at one point in Sergio, you take your shirt off and I'm like, he's so skinny. You put on, what, 40 pounds for Pablo?
I was, you know, before doing Pablo, that was sort of how I looked. I had to gain a lot of weight to play Pablo Escobar. But Sergio was a guy who was always very concerned with his. He exercised all the time. He was so he was a handsome dude. He had to, you know, he had a very. He was very, always very, wherever he was, even if he was like in East Timor, or he was jogging every day.
So how'd you gain the weight, and then how did you lose it?
Gain is super, is very easy.
And much more fun.
And much more fun. You know, I'm seeing my kids playing here, and I remember that when I started working on Pablo, I was hanging out with them and eating whatever they were having, you know, pizzas and burgers and fun. But there was a point when that started to make me feel really bad because that wasn't my body, right? It was, you know, it was, and I was just eating junk food. Yeah. And that was really bad for me. That was really, I don't know if I would do that again. Mm.
And then how'd you end up losing it? How long did it take?
To lose, it was like when I wrapped Narcos, I wanted to get rid of not only the weight itself, but I wanted to get rid of the energy of that character. So I started, I started to eat vegan for, till today, I don't eat meat nor chicken after, and that was after Narcos. And exercise in boxing and jiu-jitsu, which is something that the only sport that I really like and do.
Now I'm going to take a short break, but when we return, Mora reveals what happened when he reached out to DeMello's family. Plus, he recalls meeting Ana de Armas for the first time. And then later, my second guest on this week's Big Ticket, Sandra Oh. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Big Ticket. Here's Mora Wagner Mora. You're also a producer on Sergio. Tell me a little bit more about what you said. You said, you know, you want to see more... Latin people portrayed in ways that aren't stereotypical.
We are the most sub-represented group, ethnical group in Hollywood. Not only regarding to the amount of characters that Latin actors play, but especially the way they are seen. The stereotypes are very. And this is coming from a guy who played Pablo Escobar. It's like always the violent Latino or the sexy Latina or the everything is related to or either crime or and I think it doesn't represent what this group really is in the American society. You know, when I saw, for example. And I think this is changing. When I saw Diego Luna playing in that Star Wars film, you know, Rogue One, doing that character with his Mexican accent, and I thought that's pretty much what this should be. You know, different we can play, you know, the Star Wars dude, or you know, doctors, engineers, or it doesn't have to be related to the issues that we know that Latin America has, you know, which are poverty, violence. All that is true, and all that is part of issues that this part of the world has, but not necessarily all the characters portrayed in this is not only a political issue. It's based on the reality, you know. It's not a truthful representation.
In addition to Star Wars having Diego Luna there, have there been other recent depictions lately that you were just blown away by, saying, "I can't believe they did that"?
My Ana de Armas, who plays Carolina in Sergio, is a rising star in Hollywood, and she's just played Marilyn Monroe in a film which is the biggest American icon ever. You know, it was played by a Cuban actress. You know, it is changing. It is
So tell me about working with Ana de Armas. I mean, this is before Knives Out, before Hollywood discovered her. You have chemistry, obviously. Tell me about what it was like on set with her.
It was great. She's really great. First time I met her, we had lunch here in a restaurant here in Westwood. I was editing my film, the film that I directed, and she showed up so we could, you know, meet up before the shootings. And I had an immediate connection with her. She's a very grounded woman, very, all these things that we are discussing here, all this matters a lot to her, representation and she's an awesome actress. You know, she's a very, very, very good actress. And I was very pleased to be working with her in surgery. Also, she's very fun to hang out with. She's a great person to have around.
And how much contact did you have with real friends and family of Sergio to get prepared for the role?
No, as a producer, I thought that ethically I had to reach out to them before starting the project. I wanted them to know I was going to make a film about Sergio. So I reached out to his sons and to his ex-wife in Geneva, and also I reached out to Carolina Larriera in Rio. Sent emails to both of them. Both of them responded very skeptically, because there is a fight of narratives in towards Sergio's life, right? So and Carolina in one side and the sons and in the other side. And I didn't want our view, which is what matters in the end, how we see the story, to be contaminated by either side. We had to look at Sergio the way we believed was it. So we had Samantha Power, we had Greg Boyle, we had, you know, and we believed what we were, that we were the Sergio that we wanted to portray, regardless of interferences, you know, comprehensive interference, because, you know, I know they wanted to control the narrative over, you know, an important person for them. It's completely understandable.
Wagner, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Take care, man. Take care of yourself.
That was Wagner Mora. Sergio streams on Netflix tomorrow, April 17th. Coming up after the break, you don't want to miss it. Sandra Oh, the Killing Eve star, gets candid about life during COVID-19 and what she was getting ready to do before the world shut down. I'll be right back with Oh after the break. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Sandra Oh. How are you? How are we all doing? It's just unreal.
It's unreal. Like, Are you here? You're here in LA, yeah?
Yeah, I'm in LA.
I was looking outside. It's raining. And usually, I got to tell you, we'd be so happy for the rain. It's like, oh, so much rain this deep into the season.
No, with coronavirus and rain, I'm thinking there are going to be zombies. And
I know. But I'm like so happy to kind of like connect with you. It's like, I'm just making a little bit of tea.
Go ahead. So how are you coping? What are you doing in quarantine?
Well, I have my apron on, which I feel like I could take off right now. Off comes the linen apron. I'm cooking a lot. Actually, yeah. Honestly, it's like, I think probably with a lot of people, I am, connecting with people a lot, Zoom and FaceTiming people. I'm trying to do exercise classes. I'm really trying to do one thing a day. It's just try and do it, because it's really immediately the amount that you're sitting now. Even though, we live in Los Angeles and we do drive a lot, yep. The amount that you're sitting now has just increased enormously, exponentially. And then, for my own practice, I have a meditation practice, and I find that has been a real anchor for me during this time to manage a lot of the interior landscape that is going on, and it's a very private thing, but I will say it's a real lifeline to me,
Can I ask you how you're been,
yeah doing you how are you doing inside and how you're doing outside, and
can I ask you how long you've been meditating?
For over a decade, I'd say. Since I feel it coincided a lot with actually the start of Grace. So that's a 2005. Mm. So right around there-ish, I'd say.
Wow. I'll do it. And then I'm like, Mark, I can never get my brain to shut up, which is the whole point of meditation, is to get your brain to shut up. So,
No, want to know, I'll take issue with that. It's actually not to get your brain to shut up, is to actually just be with it.
Right.
Which is not easier, baby. It is so not easier. It's like every single time I feel like I'm on my cushion, and it's like you're in the ring, you're on the mat with your own mind. But I have, like, for me, realized that I need to sit much longer for it to actually chill the noise out a little bit.
Right.
Just to kind of have to be able to, be really present to even like settle yourself down.
And I saw you did the Olivia Wilde video, and you talked.
Oh, I'm so glad that just came out. Yeah.
You have a brother-in-law who's an ER doctor in New York City, huh?
Yeah, I have family members who are in the field. My brother, my sister-in-law, they're both.
Did I just say New York City? I meant Vancouver, right?
Vancouver. Yeah.
Yes.
My brother, my sister-in-law, they're research scientists, so they work in labs, and my brother-in-law is an ER doc, and it's really intense. If one is blessed to have a doctor in the family, it's always a blessing, because you're always texting them with a weird request. It's like, will you please take a look at this rash? Please take a look at this rash. Is it okay? On other circumstances, like the most important ones, like this is the entire reason really why you are a doctor. Sorry, I don't know how to shut that thing off. And it becomes really, really serious. It becomes really, really serious, and it becomes, you come to like the questions of what do you do? Mm-hmm. How do you want to be? Who do you want to be? And, when I was talking to my brother-in-law, Scott, he was just like from the most noble place of why you hopefully go into the profession, which is to care for people.
no matter what.
No matter what. It is service, no matter what, you know, and it is, as we are seeing, the noblest of professions. Our healthcare workers, our nurses, our teachers, everyone is, you know, bound, anyone who has, you know, children in any form, whether they're in, university or like, you know, my brother who has like a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, man, it's like everyone is bowing down to teachers as well to see, you know, well, it's just a time to reevaluate. Reevaluate, like, what is important?
Right. And I just hope after all of this is hopefully over at one point, mm-hmm. we don't forget about those teachers and those EMT workers.
Absolutely not.
And that's what makes me sad, because I think we just have these really short memories.
Well, it will be, you know, again, it's like, how do we want to be? You know, how is this time going to affect us all? How is it going to, it's only been, let's say, a couple months, you know, let's say in the United States, in North America, we have no idea how this is going to play out. We don't know how long. And so with that, we have no idea how we are as a society and as individuals going to be affected and then choose how to behave from that effect, you know? It's like, I think we've all not only are aware of the service that we all depend on, but, you can ultimately choose to like pay attention to that or not. I mean, not to get into it too much, because I do want to talk about the show too, but it's like,
we will, I promise.
Because it's also like, you know, different ways of service.
Of course.
You know what I mean? And Western thought is much more individualistic, you know, mm-hmm. and there's wonderful things to that and powerful things to that. And also it's time to see us more as a connective whole, you know, and even us, you know, chatting, you know, we're doing our part in that as well.
You'll hear my dogs.
Yes. See, I love that. It's like, hello, life.
No, it's when the landline, every once in a while, someone calls the landline, and that's their reaction when the phone rings.
Like,
it's wild.
Daddy, what is this landline? I can't understand it.
They think it's a dog whistle. Let me ask you, were you in production on anything when the world had to shut down? What were you doing?
Yeah, you know, I feel like that Friday the 13th is kind of like when Hollywood went down. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, I this was going to be like a tremendously busy year for me. Mm. I was going to go up. I was just ready to go up to Vancouver to shoot a horror film. Yes, a horror film. Yeah, in the wilds of North Vancouver, I guess. A film that will hopefully continue its life after COVID. We'll get around to shooting it, called Umma, UMMA, which means mother in Korean. And I was about to go, you know, it's like, and it's also like this, like when you prepare for a project, in my mind, I equate it to like, you're getting ready for the Olympics. You mm-hmm. spend all your time getting completely focused. You're physically ready. You're emotionally ready. You know, you're just getting all your training is in your body and you're just ready to go. You want to get up there, get into your new flat, get everything ready, and then start shooting. Go, 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 go. And then it's just to a screeching halt. And, you know, to the other projects, it's like, you know, I have this project with Amanda Peet called The Chair.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully, we don't know. We were scheduled to shoot that in the summertime and then in the fall go back to Killing Eve. And I just think it's a very, very, very interesting time for our profession because it's so, and like everything else, is connected to so many things I just don't know. I don't know. And you know, hopefully those projects will all, I'll be able to shoot them all again whenever we start up.
And what have you thought about when you're here?
Yeah.
People in higher office saying the China virus. Well, how do you even react?
Oh, that's in some ways a bigger question and a bigger conversation, because you don't have to look too far in any kind of way to see this president and the administration promoting racism in their policies and in the choices of words, and something like calling the virus, China virus, and not taking any kind of responsibility of seeing what that xenophobia and that hatred provokes in a people, is just completely reprehensible, you know. I also think, and you know, really feel that people know and understand what a global crisis this is. And there is no time and no place for racism. We don't have time for it.
Well, we do have plenty of time right now to be watching Killing Eve.
Yay! Time for Killing Eve, yes.
Right now, we're going to have to take another short break. But when we return, O weighs in on Tiger King and how she's trying to keep her parents safe during the coronavirus pandemic. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's more of Sandra Oh. Okay, could we just talk about Villanelle not making sure that Eve was dead?
Okay. I can't wait for people to talk about that, because I have my own theory, you know what I mean, which might not be in line with the writers or even Jody, because I don't really know what Jody felt like. It's like, you know, I think that because I was just like, for me, and that's also like I find very, very interesting that you can kind of go down different rabbit holes. I mean, I will spill the beans on what I thought. So what I thought is like, she knows. She's too good at her job. She knows. She can't totally do it. But that's just me. I think
that's a good thing. I didn't think about that.
Because it's like, I'm so hurt. I'm so angry. I'm going to like, even in some ways, leave it to chance.
Right.
She's going to leave it to chance because she walks away. So she does leave it for an opening of a possibility, because, you know, she doesn't wait around to see whether Eve is really dead or not. So,
well, but then the part of me, and you know this, it's like Villanelle, she's awful, right? Because she kills people the way she does.
Yeah.
But I was like, how could she be so stupid? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm cheering her on for not doing a good job.
Because that's what you really want. Because we know that, and that's the interesting thing. Even let's say in the first season when they're on the bed, and Eve, you know, pulls out a knife and to her own surprise plunges it into her gut. Villanelle at all times can overpower physically, physically can overpower Eve. But what grows and grows is Eve's influence on Villanelle's psyche, which is like, she won't, even though she can, you know? And I think everyone understands power dynamics between people in relationships, of even having power over someone or feeling that someone has power over you. And it might not be anything physical at all.
Right.
You know, and or the times where you think that you are putting up a barrier, let's say, with someone else, but later on you realize, oh, I left a door open for them. to come back in.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yes, exactly. I think everyone really kind of understands that. So even though Villanelle, you know, I think she does and believes, you know, you'll see deeper into the season that she's happy it's not true. She's happy then, she made a mistake.
Then we see her and Felix as those clowns. Was mm-hmm. this Killing Eve's ode to the Joker?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that would definitely be a conversation to have with Suzanne Heathcote, the head writer, but I don't think so. I think it was really like one, you know, you to put Villanelle in an outrageous situation and then the, you know, the horror that can happen. And no one likes clowns, really. No one really likes clowns.
But by the way, when I was younger and like I couldn't sleep at night because I was having like bad thoughts, and I'd say to my dad, I can't sleep. I'm thinking like dogs getting hurt. He'd say, think of clowns. I'm like, now they're getting beheaded. Like,
Wrong direction.
Do you think in any kind of universe, Eve and Villanelle could actually have a happy life together?
No, and I think that's what makes great drama. And I think that's what makes great romance. You know, it's the yearning that makes it's the yearning that brings people in. You know, is that storytelling, the dramatic storytelling that's based on desire and yearning, you know, and there's so much desire and yearning that each of these women have in some ways, not only for each other, you know what I mean? It's something within themselves. And I think in this season, their relationship with their, not only life, but work, it's like, I want more, or I want something different, or this life that I know, I want to get away from it. Or like, what is the 12? What is this? It's enough. Because we will see at the beginning of season 3, you know, Eve is in a deep type of retreat, you know. Oh, yeah. You see her in a completely different location. You see her doing simple tasks, almost hiding, trying to be anonymous. And that's like her really exercising her power of no. You see her saying no to a few people in the very first couple of episodes, and you know not to give too much away, but you see the way that she says no to Carolyn, and you even see the way that she says no to Kenny, who she is very, very close to, you know. And the way that she's saying no to life in some ways.
Remember the restaurant owner too, when she said, you should be in the front of the house.
And you're like, yes, no. To the restaurant owner. And it's like, no. And I don't think that she's saying no to life as in a life force, but she's saying no to saying, no, it's my choice. I want to be in the back of the kitchen making dumplings. You know, I want that. That's what is right for me right now. And then, of course, you have a catalyst that pushes her back into the hunt of things.
So tell us about Suzanne show running the third season.
You know, Suzanne has a background in playwriting and has written plays about, you know, deep dysfunctional family,
right.
Family dynamics. And I think that she's really, really put that skill into this third season, because the season itself, you know, the nature of the characters have to change. For Eve, she is in a darker place. And she's in a darker place, and that puts her in a different dramatic place. You know what I mean? So, you know, you don't really have the lightness, let's say, or the naivete that you saw at the beginning of the show.
Right.
She has gone through trauma. You know? So.
Do you have any idea how many seasons it'll go for?
not so far. I'm just glad that there is a fourth. You know, I don't know when we're going to get back. I don't know how it's going to open up. You know, having conversations with our new head writer, Laura. Laura was on our team this year, and she actually wrote episode 3. But like encouraging her to not limit herself in any way, because our show is an international show.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's not like, and it's not like we can shoot everything, you know, you can't chase the future. You don't know what it's going to be. So I, you know, we would have conversations, set it where you envision it, and we will shoot it there. Or if we have to pivot, you know, she has to have enough time to readjust, because the locations mean something. That's what I feel, and what I really want is each location really means something and has a character and is a part of the storytelling. That's what I would like it to have. So to continue that creative freedom of however the show is going to continue, that it remains an international show and continues that type of template.
Do you ever get to a point in the script where you're like, okay, this killing, how did you even think about doing it this way? Like, how many killings could they up themselves? In the saffron, the woman in the spice shop, and she's taking the saffron, and then they pull out, and the mouth is open. It's almost like Pompeii, and they were frozen in like that volcano. I guess it is.
Oh yeah. Like,
you know what I mean? Do you ever look going, who thought of this? You people are sick.
You know, you always celebrate the kills that you would never think up. You always celebrate the imaginative kills, honestly. It's like, and that's really, you know, Villanelle's domain. And it's also like, you know, a terrific, delicious part of the show where you can see, you know, the expression of, honestly, all our writers, what goes on in our writers' mind, and that is then performed and executed by Villanelle. So it's always, honestly, a treat to go, not so much the sicker, but like the more inventive is the more
that's
delicious.
That's called sicker.
Sick. Okay. The more delicious the kill. And
you're trying to be euphemism for really killings. Just a couple more questions for you, and I'll let you go. What is the first audition you ever went on, whether you got the part or not?
I really remember it. Hold on a second.
Go ahead.
I think I was around 14 or 15. I was in a student theater company called Skit Row High. You know, theater games and improv theater, really, really, really big in Canada. Really, really big in Canada. And I was really into the scene all throughout high school. So after my very first year of high school, which we call grade 9, ninth grade, I joined a student company, and from then I got a local agent, and I got a local agent because one of the girls in the theater troupe, she was doing on-screen acting, and her agent said, "Oh, do you know any young Asian actresses? Because my friend was up for a part in honestly, it was a, I'm pretty sure it was a government, a student government thing, like an anti-drinking and driving little short film PSA thing, kind of whatever. A PSA. Yeah. And so I think it was, her name was Stephanie. Stephanie then asked me, she goes, "Hey, there's this part for something. I have an agent. Do you want to go and audition for it?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And it was basically a PSA film for like, don't, kids, don't drink and drive. And it was like a mock trial where kids were pretending to be lawyers, but one of the kids actually had been drinking and driving. Anyway, But I think I was about 14, 15 when I did that, and I got the part.
You got the part.
Oh yeah.
Were you the kid who was drinking?
No. I was. I guess I played the lawyer who kept on grilling the guy.
And what's the one TV series you could watch over and over again and you never get bored?
What's the TV series that I am? Well, I will say over and over again. I realize I haven't really watched TV series over and over again, but I will say right now, I know a lot of people are very envious of me because I had never seen Breaking Bad. So now I am going through Breaking Bad and I'm on season 2, and it is, now I just understand it. So I don't know whether I would come and watch it over and over again, because it's quite an intense show, but there are times where I will be rewinding Bryan Cranston's performance. He's just like a miracle. Just a miracle to watch. It's like masterclass all the way. But I have been enjoying that.
Have you watched Tiger King?
Oh, come on, baby. Who hasn't? I have talked about that show with friends in Zoom, all the Zoom cocktails. It's like, how scary is this person? You know, and from a psychological perspective, and honestly, an acting perspective, because they're brilliant character studies. It's like when the ego hijacks everything and reactivity hijacks everything. And also the narcissistic need and desire to be at the forefront. I mean, it's an amazing study on how to be a cult leader.
Oh yeah.
Cause each of them are.
And I interviewed the husband, Dylan. Go on to Variety. Go on to Variety. You can watch it. I FaceTimed with him.
You know, I find it interesting how much do you dip in with the characters or the people that, I shouldn't say characters, people right. themselves who understand the level of awareness that there is even in the psychological play that's happening.
Right. Do you think Carol killed her first husband?
Oh, I'm not going to comment on that. Oh, I'm not going to comment on that.
You'll save that for your Zoom cocktails with your friends.
My Zoom cocktail hour. Zoom cocktail hour. Other than, you know, it's a real lesson in how, you know, not to be trapped by your ego. Jesus.
And how are your adorable parents? I have to ask.
Thank you so much for asking. They're good. They're okay. But they're very, you know, my mom is really stubborn and independent and, you know, won't let my nieces go grocery shopping for her, which stresses me out really badly, yeah. You know, really, really badly. And also, you know, we're bumping up against all these things, which is people's even mental health to exercise, their self-sufficiency, you know, mm-hmm. what it means for someone to not to be cooped up inside, you know, what it means, you know, like how much, I'm not saying that my mom loves grocery shopping, but I actually do. I really do. I find it very, very soothing. I really like it. And, you know, it's very, very sparing and not a pleasant kind of easygoing experience anymore. But, you know, you're constantly having to battle it out with, you know, the people in your family. And mostly you're battling your own anxiety, yeah.
On that note, you're amazing.
Oh, man.
This is great.
I'm so glad to kind of like...
I see you. Like,
see you and like chill out in a way of like, you know, to have these chats with people. I know we're talking about our work and stuff like that. And I'm really happy that the show's coming out earlier, because it's like there is service in what we do.
There is.
You know what I mean? To have people, you know, see familiar faces and familiar characters and like just check in. And I feel like the need to connect in a deeper and even more honest way continues to grow.
Well, Sandra, hopefully I'll see you in person.
Yes.
Sooner than later.
Yeah, yes.
And just be well. Stay safe.
You too.
That was Sandra Oh. Killing Eve airs on BBC America. Thanks for listening to this week's Big Ticket. Coming up next week, I catch up with Hugh Jackman to talk about his new film, Bad Education, as well as the host of HBO's new drag queen reality series, We're Here. Shangela, Eureka O'Hara, and Bob the Drag Queen. Until then, make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin, and check out Variety.com for all your Hollywood news. For now, stay safe, and I'll see you next week.